I'm Peter Adamson, and you're listening to the History of Philosophy podcast, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, Marketplace of Letters, Iberian Humanism. Did Spain have a Renaissance? It would seem rather unfair if the answer were no, given that the Italians and the Northern Europeans got to have one. Even the British got in on the act, despite their national devotion to the principle, we won't have what they're having. But it's been argued that Spain is the exception, on the grounds that there is no clear transition from a medieval period to a period when classical culture was being revived. And given the very different situation in medieval Iberia as compared to the rest of Europe, the context of Islamic rule defeated only at the end of the 15th century, it's clear that if there was indeed a Renaissance in Spain, it must have been rather different than the Renaissance that happened elsewhere. If we've learned anything, though, it's that the Renaissance elsewhere was also plenty diverse, and many of the hallmarks that we've come to associate with the Renaissance elsewhere, for all its diversity, are present in 15th century Spain, too. We've got scholars going to Italy to master Greek and Ciceronian Latin. We've got translators rendering classical texts into the vernacular. We've got both competition and influence between rhetoric and scholastic philosophy, and we've got a turn toward inward, individualist spirituality. Much as similar developments prepared the way for a flourishing of culture in Elizabethan England, so the 16th and 17th century in Spain are often called a siglo de oro, a golden age of philosophy and literature. Of course, this golden age was also helped along by quite a bit of real gold and silver, the riches that Spain and Portugal claimed from their overseas dominions, and those dominions too will play a role in the story of Iberian humanism. But let's start closer to home, with the collaborations between men of letters in Spain and Italy. We've often had occasion to mention visitors to Italy from around Europe who returned home with the values and skills of humanism in their baggage, men like Willibald Pirckheimer, Peter Luder, Rudolf Agricola, Etienne Dolé, John Colette, and of course, the great Erasmus himself. A comparable figure from Spain would be Nuno de Guzmán, whose wide travels brought him to Florence in 1439. Where he personally met Leonardo Bruni and Giannozzo Manetti. Guzman was active as both author and patron. From his own pen came works like a compilation of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and a revised Latin translation of Seneca on Anger, while works he commissioned from others included translations of Cicero, Macrobius, Bruni, and Seneca again. Indeed, Guzman had something of a fascination for Seneca, given that he was also the dedicatee of Manetti's Life of Seneca and Socrates. This more than a century before Lipsius's revival of Stoicism. In accounting for this fascination, the fact that Guzman was Spanish is relevant. Seneca had lived in Roman Spain, so for an Iberian humanist, he was a good candidate for the role of national hero. There was even a house in Córdoba said to be his former residence. Taking the idea further, the humanist Juan de Mena claimed that Seneca, Averroes, and Avicenna all hailed from Córdoba. Reality check. Averroes was indeed from Córdoba, but Avicenna was from near Balkh in modern-day Afghanistan, so in his case, de Mena was off by more than 6,000 kilometers. For you British listeners, that's almost 4,000 miles. Speaking of Leonardo Bruni, he was involved in a clash with a Spanish scholar who indulged in that most humanist of pastimes, insulting other humanists. This was Alonso de Cartagena, the Bishop of Burgos, who himself rendered works of Cicero and Seneca into Spanish. As I mentioned in episode 356, Cartagena had no knowledge of ancient Greek, yet charged Bruni with distorting Aristotle in his elegant Latin translation of the Ethics. Let us, he proclaimed, hack off at the root the error of those who think that philosophical meaning is less important than eloquence. This may seem strange coming from a fellow humanist, but Cartagena had studied law and theology in Salamanca, so he could also be considered a denizen of the scholastic world. As in other parts of Europe, the universities were powerfully affected by the rise of humanism. Salamanca already established a chair of rhetoric in 1403, and other Iberian universities followed suit. The long-term effects can be seen in five orations on law, given at Salamanca in 1538 and 1539 by Diego de Covarrubias y Leiva, who would go on to become an influential jurist and bishop. The orations sprinkle in references to such classical figures as Solon, Cato, and Cicero, and confirm that Salamanca has become a center of humanist activity, a marketplace of letters. They also use all the tools of Ciceronian rhetoric to exalt that paradigmatically scholastic enterprise, the study of the law. Jurists, argues Leva, are greater defenders of society than soldiers, because nothing preserves a people so effectively as good laws. Then again, a man of sufficient talent might not need to choose between legal and martial prowess. Someone who was renowned for wearing both armor and the toga, as it was sometimes put, was Iñigo López de Mendoza, the Marquis of Santillana. He distinguished himself in wars against Spanish rivals and in expeditions against Muslim forces, but also amassed one of Iberia's great libraries, wrote admired poetry, and commissioned translations of classical authors, who, of course, included Seneca. The case of Santillana shows us that humanist study was being taken up at the highest level of Spanish society, and that goes for women as well as men. Just as in Italy and France, the study of fine letters offered a way for Spanish women to establish themselves in the previously male world of learning. The most famous example is Beatriz Galindo, called La Latina, for her proficiency in Latin. Grand claims have been made for her achievements as a scholar. The 16th century historian Fernandez de Oviedo tells us that she was the Latin teacher of Queen Isabella, as just one of numerous puellae doctae, or learned ladies, gathered at the royal court. Galindo is also said to have written works of her own, including a set of notes and commentaries to Aristotle. Unfortunately, a pretty convincing article from 2021 pours a good deal of cold water on all of this. In it, Ana María Carabias Torres points out that Oviedo's evidence about Galindo is speculation made at a distance of several decades, and that the royal family already had outstanding male tutors at its disposal, including Peter Martyr de Anguiera, also significant as a chronicler at the Council of Indies. There is, argues Torres, no contemporary evidence to tell us about Galindo's work as a scholar. Torres does not question that Galindo was an accomplished Latinist, and we do have evidence that, after starting out as a relatively humble court servant, Galindo was married to a high-ranking husband, called Artillero, because he was an expert in the use of gunpowder weapons. I'd like to think that the pair would have been Arsenal supporters. The two became significant patrons, for example, by founding a hospital, and Galindo knew how to stand up for herself, litigating over her inheritance after the early demise of her explosive husband. So even accepting Torres's corrective, we can still add Galindo to our list of learned women who took advantage of humanism to win influence in a male-dominated world. In any case, it seems evident that quite a few 15th century scholars were already convinced that Spain was having a renaissance. Indeed, a humanist eulogy written upon the death of Santillana in 1458 declared that, thanks to him, eloquence had changed its true home from Italy to Spain, just as it had long ago gone from Greece to Rome, thanks to Cicero. That might sound familiar. Back in episode 397, we saw Guillaume Boudet making the same claim about humanist study emigrating from Italy to France. It's another feature of humanism that crosses borders. Philological and linguistic proficiency was often joined to a forthright nationalism. We find this also in an author who is often regarded as the greatest of the Iberian humanists, Antonio de Nebrija. In his influential grammatical work, The Art of the Castilian Language, he argued that Castilian Spanish is in no way inferior to Latin. It was published in 1492, and in that same year, Nebrija also published a Latin-Spanish dictionary. A similar sentiment was put forward by Juan de Valdez in his Dialogue on Language, in which it is concluded that of all the vernacular languages, Spanish is most like Latin, and therefore the best. In keeping with these attitudes, humanists devoted themselves to translating classical texts, and also the Bible, into Spanish. We're about to see an example of this in the work of the humanist and theologian Luis de León, who had this to say about writing in the vernacular: words are not dignified because they are Latin, but because they are used with dignity, whether they are French or Spanish. Plato did not write vulgar books in vulgar style just because he used his own vulgar language, nor did Cicero speak less highly because he used the language which was vulgar in his time. Before we get to him, though, we should pause to note that humanism was also bound up with a more famous development we associate with the year 1492, the encounter with the Americas, and the subsequent exploration and subdual of vast parts of the globe by the Iberian powers. Along with smallpox and slavery, the Spanish also brought Cicero. By the middle of the 16th century, it was possible to study Latin at a high level in Mexico City. This had been the Aztec capital city of Tenochtitlan. Maybe now this metropolis, and not Paris or Madrid, would be the new home of humanism. That was the ambition of Cervantes de Salazar, an acquaintance of the great humanist Juan Luis Vives, who, let's not forget, was also Spanish, though he spent much of his life abroad. As a converso, he would have had reason to fear persecution in his native land. Salazar also knew Hernán Cortés, the conquistador who took Mexico for Spain, and aimed to use this conquest to broaden the horizons of humanism. And not without success. Antonio Valeriano was an Amerindian who became a great Latinist, capable of speaking extemporaneously in the best Ciceronian style. And on the other side of the world, similar exploits were being pursued by the Portuguese in India. A Jesuit instructor at the college in Goa said of his students, "I recognize, so to speak, many Socrateses, I observe many Aristotles, and I hear many Ciceros," although, to speak the truth, India does not exactly abound with humanists. This is the first chapter of an important subplot within the larger story of colonialism. From the very beginning, Europeans imposed on their foreign subjects educational institutions modeled on those that already existed back home. Of course, they thought of this as a benevolent intervention, bringing the light of knowledge and true religion to benighted peoples. We tend to see things otherwise today, of course, and would be more inclined to speak of cultural imperialism. But without setting such justified reservations aside, we should notice that the Europeans did learn from the non-Europeans too, and were often well aware that they were doing so. We've seen that with Matteo Ricci and his engagement with Confucianism, and with the Relaciones de Indias, the Spanish text containing surveys of these unfamiliar lands and peoples. In India, European scholars engage with Indian texts like the two great epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Much like Ricci in his work on Chinese philosophy, they thought that they could find many parallels between Christianity and ancient Indian wisdom, something they recorded in marginal notes on these texts. Also like Ricci, they strove to master the local languages and, as a result, even noticed that the structure of these languages mirrored that of Latin and Greek. This was an early insight into the fact that Sanskrit and the classical European tongues belong to the same Indo-European language family. It's a small but striking instance of the way that humanist curiosity about language was exported around the globe. But there's more to humanism than the study of language. Thanks especially to Erasmus, the movement was intimately associated with, well, intimacy. Not of the physical kind, though humanists did produce more than a few works on the subject of love. What I mean is the Erasmian emphasis on spiritual intimacy and the search for a personal encounter with the divine. As we saw when talking about the Inquisition, the reception of Erasmus in Spain was not unproblematic. Initially, his works did enjoy popularity, especially the writings on religious ethics, like his Handbook of the Christian Soldier. But the proximity of his thought to Protestantism, and above all, his provocative scholarship on the Bible, eventually led to his being placed on the Index of Forbidden Authors. More conservative approaches to the Bible were preferred in Spain, as in a project to produce a multilingual edition of the Bible in Alcalá, called the Complutensian Polyglot, because Alcalá was called Complutum in Latin. The aforementioned leading humanist, Nebrija, was involved at first, but broke with the editorial team because he felt their philological techniques were unserious, too beholden to the received Latin version and the medieval scholarly tradition. As a self-styled conqueror of barbarism, he wanted to uphold higher standards. More adventurous, indeed dangerously so, was the aforementioned Luis de León, often called affectionately Fray Luis, or Brother Luis. Born in Cuenca in 1527, he gives us another example of the interpenetration of the humanist and scholastic worlds of Spain, because he taught at the University of Salamanca for 30 years, but also wrote poetry, translations, and treatises on humanist themes. The latter include a work on the perfect wife, which puts forward the familiar argument that, since women are far weaker than men, indeed the weakest and most abject of all animals, it's all the more admirable when they achieve virtue. As for his translations, these included works by Horace and Virgil, and a Spanish version, along with commentary of that biblical ode to intimacy of the more physical kind, the Song of Songs. Fray Luis invoked a whole philosophy of language to support his translation efforts, which homed in on the meaning of each individual word of the text, to the point that he tried to produce a translation that had exactly as many words as the original. A modern commentator says of the result that it must be one of the least comprehensible things ever to have appeared in Spanish. But the method fit with his broadly Aristotelian philosophy of language. Words in natural language are images of our thoughts, which are themselves images of things out in the world. Some words perform their imaging function more adequately than others, and Hebrew words are the best, because this was the first human language. Which is where things got dangerous. In his writings and university lectures, Fray Lewis repeatedly argued that the Hebrew text of the Old Testament gives us the best access to the revelation, even if, like any text, it had been subject to corruptions over time. This might seem pretty obvious. Surely with any book, we should prioritize reading the original language version. But some felt that the so-called Vulgate Latin version produced by Jerome in antiquity was preferable, insinuating that the Hebrew version had been deliberately modified by Jewish scholars over the ages, for instance, in order to conceal prefigurings of the coming of Christ. Besides which, the Council of Trent had just declared the Latin version to be authentic. "Quite," said Fray Lewis, "but the difficulty lies in the meaning of the word authentic." He preferred a more Erasmian view, according to which the Vulgate was admitted to be the best Latin version available, yet far from perfect, meaning that there was need to return to the original Hebrew and Greek of the Old and New Testaments to get an improved version of the text. This position brought him into conflict with a colleague named Leon de Castro, a professor of Greek with more conservative philological attitudes, and then it brought Fray Lewis into conflict with the Inquisition, an almost inevitable result given that he was a converso with daring theological views. He was arrested in 1572. His work on the Song of Songs was charged with being too frank in its discussion of its erotic themes. An accuser said that in his hands, this part of the Bible might as well be a love letter by Ovid. Fray Lewis responded that he had only been trying to capture the literal, not the spiritual significance of the text, but the text did have such a further significance, or even many further meanings. In fact, this is why he insisted on engaging with the original Hebrew of the Old Testament. No translation could convey the full import of the original, written as it was in a language of few words and brief phrases, which are full of different meanings. The inquisitors chastised him for this attitude, since he seemed, after all, to be questioning the authenticity of the Latin version. Fray Lewis boldly responded, "That the Hebrew language is equivocal is not my fault. Let them blame God. He created it." Elsewhere, he admitted that there are no hard and fast rules for teasing out the full range of meanings present in the biblical text. "Let the mind and reflection of a spiritual man and the reading of good authors be both guide and teacher in this art." He was eventually set free, though only after several years in prison, and allowed to resume his teaching duties. The story has it that he began his first lecture back at the university with the words, "As I was saying last time," you can't help liking the guy, and that's before we get to his more literary works, of which a modern-day scholar has written, "No one should imagine himself to have mastered the Castilian idiom until he has been able to experience a pervasive and overpowering aesthetic pleasure in reading the elegant, restrained, solemn, classical, musical, harmonious, persuasive, serene, and intense prose of Fray Luis de Leon." My high school Spanish isn't even close to meeting that standard, I'm afraid, but I can still admire the ambition and philosophical themes in Fray Luis's poems as well as his prose. Among the former, we have an ode written in honor of the blind musician, Salinas. This is what I was thinking of in the last episode, the interview with Scott Williams, when I mentioned that philosophy of disability would come up in discussing Spanish humanism. As it happens, Fray Lewis makes exactly the point I was suggesting about Plotinus in that discussion, namely that physical eyesight grasps only deceitful, fleeting beauty and is worthless in comparison to the truer, inward vision of higher realities. Music of the kind produced by Salinas is like a sea of sweetness, whose aesthetic power is such that it can convey us to those realities. While this clearly evokes themes from Neoplatonism, Fray Lewis is a deeply Christian author whose greatest prose work is entitled On the Names of Christ. Needless to say, this treatise is of a theological nature, but it rewards philosophical attention too. It's a classic humanist dialogue, a discussion held between three friends chatting in a bucolic setting. They move through 12 different ways of referring to Christ, a project that may remind us of the divine names of another Platonist author, the Pseudo-Dionysius. Like Dionysius, Fray Lewis considers the names appropriate to created things as mere symbols of divine reality, so that in this context at least, all words are ultimately metaphorical. Like the music of the blind Salinas, the right sort of language brings us towards an encounter with divinity, until the soul, subject completely to the sweetness, completely transported and wholly lifted above herself, and no longer contained within herself, breathes forth love and tenderness, and melting away in her every part, and neither speaks nor understands anything save light, love, life, supreme rest, infinite beauty, immense and sweetest good. This sounds downright mystical, suggesting as it does that the soul could even achieve identity with God. Elsewhere in the work, though, Fray Lewis pulls back from that radical suggestion, saying carefully that the soul can be transformed almost into God. He has good reason for caution, since, like philological work on the Bible, an interest in mysticism was something that could get you into hot water in the time of the Inquisition. The authorities worried about the spiritual excesses of mystically inclined groups, especially the Alumbrados, who I already mentioned when telling the story of Juan de Vergara and his brother. You'll remember them as the ones who used citrus juice as invisible ink, cunningly hoping to defeat the Inquisition using a tool of espionage familiar to your average 7-year-old. Yet some of the greatest treasures of Spain's golden age would be produced by spiritual and mystical authors like John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila. Fray Lewis was involved in that story too, because he was an editor of Teresa's works and also a defender of her thought. As far as he was concerned, anyone who opposed her must be possessed by the devil. So I can't imagine what might possess you to miss the next episode when we'll be looking at Spanish mysticism here on the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps.